Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health.
Hello, this is Angie DeRosa, Senior Editor of Contemporary OBGYN. In this next interview, we interview two doctors, an obstetrician and gynecologist, Dr. Vanessa Rogers, who is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Chair of the Division of Education and Faculty Development, and the Norman F. Gant Chair in Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. She is joined by Dr. Shauna Nesbitt, who is a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine in the Division of Cardiology, Hypertension Section, and Associate Dean for Student Affairs in the Office of Student Diversity and Inclusion, also at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. This video is a supplement to our cover story in August, in which Dr. Rogers conducts a Q&A with Dr. Nesbitt. The title of the story is Overcoming Racism and Unconscious Bias in the OBGYN Practice. The women got together with us in this video, and we hope you really take in and learn from what they have to say. Thank you, and continue to follow us online, contemporaryobgyn.net, for more coverage, and look forward to the August issue. Thank you. Thank you both for being here with us today. You were the first Black student to complete that three-year medical program at Gannon.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a joint program between, it was a joint program between Hahnemann and Gannon at the time that was intended to increase the number of doctors coming back to that area specifically. And they never had any African-Americans in the program. And so when I came to do the program, I didn't even know that at the time that I actually chose to go there, because it was the sole reason that I picked that school was to do that program. And it wasn't until I actually got to Hahnemann that they told me, you know, you're our first Black student to complete this program that we've ever had since we had that relationship, which is like, oh, okay, well, now I got to make sure I finish this.
Right. What was that like?
It was interesting. You know, I had grown up, you know, in Aliquippa, which is, of course, very segregated at the time, very Black in where I lived. And because of race riots during the late 60s, my parents chose to send us to private schools in Baden, which you might even remember that. Mountain Glitzen Academy, which we were the only Black family, two Black families, us and one other. And so we carpooled together to go to school together every day. And you, in a lot of ways, get used to being the only one. In a way, some positive, some negative about that. Initially, struggles between living in Aliquippa and going to school with all white kids, because I didn't realize that there were two different languages to be spoken until I got to school and I started to speak like I spoke at home, and the kids looked at me like, what are you saying? You know, you don't speak well, you don't speak right, or what do you, they treated me very different. It was like a, you know, condescending look. So when I went home, of course, you adapt to what you hear.
Yes.
And then at home, I came back speaking the way I spoke at school. Right. And my friends at school no longer accepted that. It was, you think you're better than us. You think you're a white girl. That's not good either in that neighborhood. And so I quickly kind of learned, okay, now you've got to learn to speak this way at home and this way at school, and the two should never meet. Mm-hmm. And that way of living actually is an adaptive way to live. particularly for the times, but it continues on. It really does. I mean, it's taken a long time. It took a long time for me to get to a point in my life where I felt comfortable that it didn't matter anymore to me. Mm-hmm. Who thought what? Because after getting to medical school and all of that, and, you know, a couple of degrees, you go home and no one is really expecting you to sound like you used to sound. So I guess those sort of requirements were gone by that time. And then again, every place I've gone, I've always been one of very few. And I knew how to speak that language very well. So most were comfortable, but if I flipped into the more vernacular language of home, it didn't have the same twist as it did when I was younger. So it is not unique to me. It's the mm-hmm. way we all kind of learn how to live. And in a lot of ways, as I've been thinking about this a lot, as Vanessa and I have been talking, mm-hmm. that it may be part of our problem to mm-hmm. a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Because of the language barrier and conversations that we don't have, mm-hmm. the risks that neither side takes to really come together and understand who you are, where you are, what your life is like, makes the gulf even wider between the two populations. Even though you are existing in exactly the same space all the time, you're living a totally different life that no one even has a concept of what you're having to go through because they're not comfortable taking the risk that the other side, either way, will accept it.
Yeah. So as I was telling Dr. Rogers, we had the interview last week, and it's sort of running side by side with the interview with Dr. Washington Hill. He's been a practicing OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist in Sarasota for 55 years that he's been practicing. And I believe 30 of those have been in Sarasota. And some of the things that he shared with us were pretty stunning. But as we speak today, he's probably there with the officials in his hospital system advocating for the addition of a chief diversity officer.
Yeah.
Taken to task on their language, how they present, missing the word diversity in some key communications.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to really, you know, especially in the world of OBGYNs, talk to you and get your insight about how OBGYNs, practicing OBGYNs, can use their influence to affect these types of changes within their own practices, hospital systems, et cetera, and make sure it's happening from the top down.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
And so what would your advice be, Dr. Nesbitt?
Well, I think, you know, all of this is about, I think it all begins with self-reflection, mm-hmm. is looking at, you know, who are you? What are your influences? What do you know and what do you not know? And being willing to step outside of what you know. I think as physicians, we're trained to be very knowledgeable and be confident in what you know, because your job is to convince people that what you're telling them is the right thing to do, which sometimes means that we are not willing to admit that we don't know something, because that's counter to what we're supposed to do. In this instance, I don't think medical knowledge ever prepares you for these questions in any way. And in fact, I think medical school in and of itself in some ways undoes what you may have learned in a personal life experience, because it shifts you to only look for hard evidence that has been proven by multiple people before you to show that it's true. And this is something that is A, not well documented, for the same reasons that it continues to exist. And so just like we have racism across the board in all aspects of society, it exists in medical publication of what is written about what's happened in the past and how race has seeped into healthcare. It makes it more challenging for the individual to now marry what happens in society to what happens in medicine, and how do we figure that out? So I think first is really thinking about you, thinking about what you know, what you don't know, and then working to fill that deficit. The second piece is being aware of where you are. Is that, you know, I think medical schools and large hospitals tend to work in a vacuum a lot. And we don't necessarily, we assume that a hospital in Miami is the same as a hospital in Ohio. And that is not true. We are all serving the same general purpose. We are not serving the same population. And each population has uniquenesses about who's there and what the need is. And so I think beginning to then embed yourself in what's happening with the people you are actually serving. Who are they? What's their background? What are their needs? If you have a population that's largely immigrant, then what are the needs and where are they coming from and what are their perspectives on healthcare, and particularly childbearing is an incredibly personal, culturally deeply embedded kind of thing about how you think about, you know, what you want for having a baby and what you want for raising your child, that can be really, really different from one culture to another culture. And I will say that a lot of times in America, we think of culture when we say that word, we're thinking of people who are not in the United States, but we've got different cultures existing within the United States that are not necessarily driven by external countries. And so, you know, for instance, immigrants from Nigeria mm-hmm. are different from African Americans who are descendants of slaves. Our color is the same and hair texture, and we have some of the same sort of concerns, but culturally, the development of African American culture is largely shaped by the experience of being in America and being Black and being a slave, and that whole journey changes you that immigrant Black populations don't really have. They have a different set of things. And I think that that's just one example of how the differences can exist and the subset of understanding that, or for lack of a better word, actually what I really like more is cultural humility.
Okay.
That humility, it's that sort of backing up to say, I don't understand this culture. We've got a large population of people that we're trying to serve. How am I going to learn about them? And so spending some time with them allows you to develop the comfort level and familiarity, because as I alluded to before, it's about beginning to take the risk of having the conversation with somebody on a one-on-one level. Mm-hmm. And no one feels comfortable doing that until they're at least this much knowledgeable that they're not stepping into, you know, dog do when they say something, but asking a question that is real and is personal that allows them to begin to open that up. And so I think that can happen internally with the staff of who you bring into your office, is that your office needs to be representative of people who you're serving, because that office staff is really going to help you a lot. And you have some comfort level of asking them questions that maybe you don't want to ask outside of that, because now they're part of your team. And I would say if you develop your team to have those people as a part of it, use them. Let them be a resource for you more than just to file the papers for you, to help you to understand what it is that, you know, you may need to meet with. And then finally, I think it is looking at the whole system. Is that, you know, we've got to start looking at our system to see what are our systematic barriers, because we think of systematic racism and, you know, it sounds really big. It must be just in Washington, D.C. And the truth is not. It is small systems that have repeated assaults that continue on, and we're not going to fix that until we fix one system at a time that addresses a very specific need that is very specific to who it is that you're talking to, that's different from place to place.
Dr. Rogers, would you like to contribute to that part of it and say what you see from your position in OBGYN?
Yeah, I mean, I think I take this from one of the many things Dr. Nesbitt has taught me, which is you have to ask. And so if you're serving in a hospital role, unless you go to the hospital and ask, what are we doing for diversity? You know, what necessarily is their motivation to do so? And I think, you know, in OB-GYN, if there's a new piece of equipment you want, there is something, a service you want to bring to the hospital, you would go to the hospital and you'd explain why you think it was important, and they would hopefully accommodate you. And I think that this is no different. And so I think as physicians, we are inherently given a certain degree of power just from our education and our experience. And then we have to make the choice to use that power to bring awareness to the topic and start working at sort of, you know, nibbling away at systemic racism, which is such a huge topic that touches on so many things. And each of us do our own little part to contribute to the solution. And I think if we do that, what we're asking really from the hospital, you know, we're not asking them just to say it. It's not about putting a word in a document. It's about saying we're going to learn and understand the needs of our patients, the needs of our staff, how everyone is influenced in society, how they're affected, and work collectively as a group to find equality through equity and make it a better environment for everyone.
And you know, that's a beautiful segue. Dr. Hill and I were talking about this, and I admit I need to drill down and understand it better, but the equality versus the equity. And I wanted to go to Dr. Nesbitt for your expertise on that and how systemically it can get granular and the meanings for equity versus equality.
Thank you for that question. It is, I think, the quintessential question. Because I think in many ways, many of us, not everybody, but many of us have moved beyond, you know, sitting in the back of the bus and things that are very obviously racist, white sheets, those sort of things. Most people are, you know, really abhorred by that. But what we haven't accepted as a society is the difference between those two terms, is that, you know, if you were offering jobs and you wanted to enhance, that was your goal, to enhance diversity, one might say, well, we have a job to be equal to everyone. And so as long as we offer this opportunity to everybody, that we've done our part. However, if you're looking at the pool and you look at these candidates available to you, mm-hmm. and you have one group of candidates, A, who is overrepresented in the group, and B, have never had the opportunity of learning about the system, your system, never had the opportunity to have others before them to expose them to what that's like. And now you're trying to compare them on exactly the same basis. And I'll add to that is that the educational exposure, meaning the schools that they were permitted to attend and the limitations thereof, have caused them to now be down here. Whereas the other members of that pool may be here because they've naturally had the privilege of having those experiences that have been very much far above this group of individuals. And so now you're offering the same opportunity. And now you say, well, I'm going to judge them only on pure merit, as we define merit to be. And most of the time that is quantitatively measured. And if you choose the non-minority person, we'll say, and feel like you've done your job, and you say, well, it's equitable. It's not really equitable because of the fact that's what systemic racism does, is that it creates this situation of inequitable resources that are so deep and so far beyond the scope that if one wants to actually create equity, you have to take those things into consideration in order to create equity. And it isn't a matter of saying that, well, I'm just going to take you because you're Black or because you're Hispanic. It is to say that, A, I intentionally want to have the diversity that is representative of the group that I want, and I'm creating an environment that is rich with different perspectives. So that brings value to the organization in and of itself. Secondly, is that if you're taking someone and you recognize that, well, they haven't had as much exposure or experience as I would like, is that you're willing to say, I'm going to bring this person with a purpose for mentoring them to become, because that's part of the equity that you are creating. And it's big. I admit, it's not an easy thing. And it's not so simple as to say, boom, bring you in the door. But it is a situation that you have to decide you're going to take that on. I think if that were taken on by more entities, we would have a quicker, you know, conversion to a more equitable situation, because everybody would be taking on a little brother or a little sister basically to create that. And it really does in some ways require deep thought about, you know, in every situation, what are you thinking? Equality is everybody gets exactly the same, but equity is everybody comes up to the same level, which means some are going to require two steps and others are going to require one step. That's the simple piece of it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, Dr. Hill and I were talking about insurance. You know, some of the insurance differences in his situation, where there would be patients who they're offering this insurance, but there are no providers for it in a given area. And so then that person needs to get transportation or has childcare issues to be able to make that longer trip to go to a provider, say in Tampa, versus where he is in Sarasota. And so Dr. Rogers, we'll get you to weigh in too and see how in your area in Dallas you've experienced this equity versus equality and how you see things evolving for for the better.
You know, I think I always have hope, of course, that it will improve. And I think what's interesting about it is the degree of disparity. And so, you know, where you are in the healthcare system in any large city will certainly change your impression of all of these things. And so I serve a very underserved population in Dallas County. I serve pretty much an exclusively minority population. And so a lot of emphasis is placed on these, you know, on healthcare disparity and these social circumstances that can impact acquisition of care. For example, transportation and childcare. And how do we make it easier for our patients to seek out care? And it can be, do they have access to resources for copays? Do they have access to Wi-Fi? If you would like to provide them information, as we frequently do now, that's electronic. And you really have to take all of those things into account. The benefit of working in the environment in which I work is, you know, because I'm in a public hospital, it's a tax-exempt organization, we do, through the Affordable Care Act, we have done these community health needs assessments that we have to do by law every 3 years. And you start studying patient outcomes, morbidity, mortality, life expectancy, and the disparities you find depending on what zip code you live in and who you are really dramatic. And so you have to know that,
yes,
in order to then start working towards solutions to serve your patients. And so if you don't really take the time to get to know, you know, what the situation is for your patients, you can't do that. So I think that would be a very, you know, that experience I have would be very different from someone who's perhaps serving a more affluent, homogeneous population in Dallas, who will simply say, you can't bring a child to the doctor's appointment. And if you don't have childcare, please reschedule. You know, how many patients are then precluded from getting the healthcare that they need? And what is the long-term impact of that on their health and the health of their family?
What would you suggest to clinicians that don't have that access to those surveys? You know, maybe they work at a different hospital that doesn't require that. How would you suggest that they go about surveying their patients and things like that, getting that data?
I mean, it's not easy. You have to be proactive, and it takes time and it takes energy. And Dr. Nesbitt and I have had this conversation of, you know, providing perhaps surveys to your patients to find out, to ask. Again, it always comes back to asking. What can we do to help you and make it easier for you to access healthcare? Mm-hmm. And you can presume what the answer is going to be, but I guarantee you what you'll find is there will be some surprises in there. And I think what you can do is you can't perhaps solve every problem, mm-hmm. But you could make some small changes that might really impact someone's life. So I think asking is really, really important. And I think you can do that actually pretty easily with surveys and things of that nature.
And so that leads into and we could talk about this for a while, but the social determinants of health and cultural awareness in the delivery of reproductive health care. And, you know, it's a statistic that's astonishing each time I hear it, but the maternal mortality rate, black women, yeah, 3 to 4 times more than their white counterparts. So how do we begin to address this? And I know it's a complex issue, but Dr. Nesbitt, I would like to get your take on that first, and then Dr. Rogers, we'll have you discuss it.
Thank you. It is a huge undertaking, I will say, but it is not different than almost any other problem we look at in healthcare. Is that, you know, frequently we're looking for a one-stop shop answer for these things, and there is not a one-stop shop answer. If we're talking about a neighborhood of folks, and you know, South Dallas is local to us, and a lot of the population coming to Parkland comes from that location, that area is a food desert. And so if nutrition is an important part of, you know, a baby's intrauterine growth, how can they grow well if the food that they're eating is inappropriate and not well-balanced? If you think about transportation from that area to get to anywhere is more challenging. And so being able to actually make it to your appointments on a regular basis in a timely manner is challenged. So if the weather happens to be bad and it's raining outside and you've got other children, bringing your kids to that visit may be a real problem. We look at homelessness and we look at joblessness. Those are the populations that have the highest rates. And it goes on and on and on that creates this cloud of difficulty. You know, how does police brutality fit into that? It fits into that in a very specific way, is that you create an air of distrust to authority, because when authority is engaged, it becomes a threat rather than a support. And so there's a withdrawal from many of the areas where that help could be rendered, but the impression is that, I don't know how that's going to be received. I'm not sure what that brings to me. Maybe I should avoid that. Mm-hmm. And the big looming characteristic is that in recent days, I'm teaching a course and we're looking at specifically social determinants of health, and we spent some time in the county jail. The county jail of Dallas is overrun with men of color. And if you look back historically at how is it that a jail in a county that is only 13 or 14% Black can have, you know, nearly 60 or 70% of the males there are Black. We've set the jail system up to be another system of Jim Crow, unfortunately, and there's a great book about that. But we've set that up, and so that destroys the family, it destroys the fabric, it destroys the confidence. You know, it sets up a long history of failure and disenfranchising. Those things are all not biological, but they tie directly into the biological factors that contribute to a healthy mom and a healthy baby and a healthy relationship that present to Dr. Rogers for her to take care of them. And so when they present to her, they're carrying the weight of the world. And, you know, it's very hard for their care provider to overcome all those things in one answer. Mm-hmm. So I think that to come back to your real question to me is that I think, A, we need to understand where are these people coming from? You know, what are the issues that they are specifically facing? We know the area, the general neighborhood and what that looks like and what the needs are. But for you, one patient that I am taking care of, what is your greatest need and how can I help you to overcome that need, whether that be the social worker that understands very well how to get proper food, can help them with some of the other things of their lives that really make a difference. I think that from a doctor's perspective is where we have to start going. At healthcare systems like in ours, we have now a social determinants of health wheel that is on the patient's record. And when the patient presents, all of those questions will tell you, you know, where is the greatest need? And so looking at that wheel can be helpful for the individual provider to say, I need to talk to them about nutrition, or I need to talk to them about transportation, because that's what the biggest piece of their wheel that's deficient in how they present to you.
Yes. And I'm nodding like I am, because real quick, I don't want to, Dr. Rogers is going to take her part, but I went to graduate school in Oklahoma, at the University of Oklahoma. And what was staggering there, and we started doing more studies on it and looking into it, was the number of women incarcerated for nonviolent offenses within that state. And then if you broke it down even more, to the women of color, and then the number of children that ended up in the foster care system.
Yeah.
And then all of those things that happen as a result of that. So anyway, don't want to get off course too much, but Dr. Rogers.
What was that book called that you mentioned that there was a book on that? What was the title?
The New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow.
Michelle Alexander. It's a very good book. Actually, it was published 10 years ago, and it's republished in 2020. And it also has a workshop book that is accompanying it.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Rogers, did you want to give your take on?
Yeah, it's such a multifactorial issue. And I think what we as providers are tasked to do is to identify the issues that are impacting our outcomes and then try to resolve those issues. And so in Dallas, you know, at our public hospital, we have a prenatal care system that involves clinics that are spread very strategically around the city to serve populations so that may have more difficulty accessing care at the main hospital. So that transportation is less of an issue. It's a little bit, they're smaller, they're more intimate. We ideally have these clinics serve not only just the pregnant woman, but they do well women care, contraception. Sometimes pediatricians will be there so they can take care of the whole family. And so I think access to care is a huge part. And I think you have to really know what the challenges are to your patients accessing care. And who's going to access care if there's distrust? So it's taking the time and building relationships with your patients, which I think in medicine is getting increasingly difficult because of time constraints and documentation and all the things that we know. But until you've built that relationship, you have to understand that you'll have a group of patients that will come to you with a higher level of distrust than perhaps you as an individual have earned, but it is your obligation as their physician to work past that. And you do that, you know, by getting to know your patient and asking questions. And if a treatment plan isn't going the way you hoped it would go, to really try to drill down to what the real problem is for that individual, whether it be an issue of compliance or what have you, you can't assume you know the answers to those things. You really have to ask.
And now COVID has probably complicated everything beyond anything we can imagine. That, you know, we hear Dr. Spong, her side of it here and there, but, you know, that's exposing more of these disparities.
It's hard on so many levels. You know, we are relying more on telehealth, which has its place, provided your patient, again, has access to a phone, has access to internet, and so forth. So it can be helpful on the transportation side, but you also have to make sure that you're not just substituting one challenge for another, right? If they don't have access to Wi-Fi, it's the humanistic side of medicine. You're wearing all these masks and gowns and things, and I think it makes it harder, right, to connect to your patients under all of that equipment. And it's, you know, maintaining distance. And I think too, when you have people who are nervous and perhaps frightened of the healthcare system, and then you ask them to come in with no visitors, right? Because we've limited visitors in the hope of flattening the curve. And then you ask them to go it alone, and some patients, you know, the fear of that actually prevents them from accessing care.
Okay. Dr. Nesbitt, is there anything you'd like to add? Any
before we wrap up? Yeah, I think on the subject of COVID is that COVID and the recent reprisal of police brutality and the protests has created a very caustic situation in terms of healthcare for communities of color. That there are so many levels of the issues that come together in a really terrible way that leads to improper and insufficient care because of fear. And, you know, I think the distance between coming to an office if you're worried about catching a disease, but if you're also worried about getting there safely or being stopped by the police and not surviving, it creates a whole nother air of difficulty, and people who should come will not come because of fear for multiple reasons and sit at home for all kinds of disease issues. They just won't show up in thinking that it's dangerous for them to be there. And that puts another burden on the healthcare system, and the provider is to really reach out. And I agree with Dr. Rogers with respect to doing telehealth visits is that it's challenging. It is very tough for communities of color to get completely on board with it because, quite honestly, like everything else, the systems in their neighborhoods are insufficient. They're not prepared for this, and it's hard to get them to feel comfortable with it. I've done a lot of phone visits as well as virtual visits. And, you know, I think the other part of it is time. It's being able to give a little more time to people and a little more kindness. This is simple things. It's just like being in a grocery store where you have a mask on and everybody's working hard there. I have found that in these days, smiling and greeting them makes everybody feel a little bit more comfortable. Similarly, in the healthcare environment, when you're challenged the way we're challenged, is to remember that these are human beings that we're taking care of and that we intend for them to feel that comfort level, that nurturing that we're here to provide. Whatever that means for them, we need to be sensitive to giving that back to them in the patient care arena. And I think that
thanks for listening to this episode of Pop Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Overall, we're vulnerable right now.
But thank you both so much for your time.